Hi, this is Cherise Kenyon, and you're listening to the Beauty Me podcast, all about beauty beyond the BS. This is an episode I've been so excited to share, and I've had to put it off a few times because it's all about the brilliant film Love Lies Bleeding, and the release date here in the UK has been put back a couple of times, but I'm so happy to announce that it did come out here Friday the 3rd. It's been out in the US, I think, since early April, and I'm just going to let you know right now, it's a really good film. I'm also really happy to share in this episode that I got to speak with the heads of wardrobe, hair and makeup. That's Olga Mill, Megan Dom and Frida Valenzuela, respectively. I think they all did an amazing job on a film that really does play with notions of femininity, masculinity and violence. Before we get to meet the team, I wanted to give you a little bit of background into the director, what you can expect from the film, and while I don't think you're going to find any obvious spoilers in this episode, do feel free to watch the film first and then listen, because you're going to learn so much from the film, and I promise you, you're going to learn so much from my guests.
The excitement in the air is palpable. The atmosphere is electric. A celebration of history in the making.
What is this place?
Love Lies Bleeding is British director Rose Glass's second movie. Her first was St. Maud, which I haven't seen, but it's on my list to watch ASAP. Mark Kermode, who is one of my favourite movie reviewers here in the UK, described Glass as an electrifying, thrilling new voice in his own review of Love Lies Bleeding. And he also said that St. Maud was his favourite film of 2020. So I'm even more intrigued to see that now. He said he loved that film so much that he knew at the time it was going to be really tough for Glass to follow with an even better film. But he said that Love Lies Bleeding is definitely that film. Even if I had seen St. Maud already, I doubt it would have prepared me for Love Lies Bleeding. I've seen this film once about a month ago. I got to go to a screener and it was just electric. And now that it's out in the UK, I'm definitely planning on going to see it again, because it's really one of those films that's like, did that really just happen? From the second that I watched one of the early trailers for this, I knew it was going to be a must-see movie. A little bit of background. The film is set in the 1980s in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it tells the tale of Lou, the manager of a gym, played by Kristen Stewart, and Jackie, a bodybuilder, making her way through town, headed to her first bodybuilding competition. Jackie is played by Katie O'Brien, who you might know from The Mandalorian, and I have to say, both Katie and Kristen do an amazing job in this film. They acted their butts off. Director Glass said that the movie exists in the same kind of world as three specific films. First, David Cronenberg's Crash, a controversial cult classic that came out in 1996 and was focused on a film producer who becomes involved with a group of symphorophiliacs, people who are aroused by car crashes. Glass also mentioned another cult classic, 1995 Showgirls, which was directed by Paul Verhoeven. That film is described as an erotic drama, so if you haven't seen it already, I would advise that you watch it, but maybe not with the kids or your parents around. It's definitely striking and in your face, and I get why it's so cult, in the way that some movies just aren't appreciated at the time they're released, but seem to gain some form of respect as time goes on. Finally, Glass also mentioned Saturday Night Fever, directed by John Badham. It's described as an American dance drama film, but I remember when I watched this, and I think it was only a couple of years ago, because I'd always felt like, oh, I wouldn't bother watching Saturday Night Fever. It just looks like it's just about disco. And I love disco, but I didn't really want to see John Travolta dancing. But when I watched it, I was not prepared for the dark moments. And it's funny because in this interview where Glass shares these three films, I'll share a link to it, by the way, it was on the Letterboxd channel on YouTube. She sat with Kristen Stewart, and Kristen Stewart said she watched Saturday Night Fever when she was 15 years old, and I can only imagine how shocked she must have been. When I think of those three films that Glass mentioned, I definitely get where she's coming from when she says Love Lies Bleeding comes from the same world. All of them have some darkness at the heart of them, no matter how bright or colourful or glossy that the film or the storyline or even the location might be, there's always something dark inside. However, if I really wanted to put my spin on things, I would add three other films. I would first of all throw in a little bit of 1998's American History X, a film about a neo-Nazi directed by Tony Kaye. I'd also throw in another David Cronenberg film, Videodrome, a so-called body horror from 1983, because you definitely have a visceral reaction to Videodrome as well as Love Lies Bleeding and American History X, I have to say. When I went to the screening of this film, I saw people literally covering their faces with their clothes. They didn't want to see what was happening on the screen. Me being me, I'm always going to watch everything. And yeah, there's some moments in this that are pretty grim, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't go and watch it. And actually, later on in one of the conversations, we do kind of bring up the concept of violence on screen. Finally, I'd also throw in 1999's Boys Don't Cry, a truly harrowing take on a true story of the life of Brandon Tina, an American transgender man, directed by Kimberly Pierce. It's that classically devastating tale of how a small town can ruin anyone who is seen as an outsider, even if they're one of their own. I feel compared to Glass's suggestions, my films are more dark than glamorous, but I think it's because throughout Love Lies Bleeding, there is an impending sense of doom. No matter how much fun Lou and Jackie are having, they're falling in love, Lou's helping Jackie grow her muscles with the help of steroids in the run-up to the big show, you just know that the world is not going to want these two to be together. I'm not going to tell you any more about the storyline. I don't want to ruin it for you. But I have to say, the music is also the star of this film. The music will stay with you. I was looking up different songs after I'd seen it, particularly a Nona Hendrix song, who was an iconic, well, she's still around, an iconic singer that kind of combined rock with soul. Very, very different. And she has this song called Transformation, and it's perfect for a montage. We also chat about montages later in this episode, actually. So I can't wait to share this with you. I think now is the perfect time to begin sharing my chats with the team. First of all, let's listen to Head of Hair, Megan Dahm. I start by asking her how much time she had to prepare for the movie before she moves on to where she found inspiration for not only Kristen and Katie's characters, but also the character of Lou's estranged dad, Lou Sr., played brilliantly by Ed Harris.
I started prepping, I think, roughly around the beginning of May. And we were filming, our camera tests were on June 16th. So we had about a month. It was fast. So I knew about the project a little before, but things really came together very quickly. Like even the pre-prep and scouts, that all happened not much before I became involved in it. So everything was a pretty quick prep going into. And we started filming in June. So basically we had about a month until camera tests, and then we started filming the following Monday. And our cast landed like the week of camera tests, pretty much. So it was a pretty fast. I think we had, I ended up with a little extra time and in prep because Katie, who played Jackie, was once she was cast, we knew we had to put her in a wig. Which we'll go into a little bit later with one of the, you know, with discussing the characters. But yeah, it was a pretty pretty rapid prep, it felt.
So what does the prep look like? You find out that it's you doing the job. What are you doing straight away to get ready? Is it books? Is it looking at the actors?
I knew I was doing this project before some of the actors were cast. So, you know, we had... Really, when I became involved and was starting to prep the show, the only actor who had officially signed on to it was Kristen Stewart, who plays Lou. So without knowing specifically who's going to be playing these characters, one of the things I do, I read the script and just kind of read it for enjoyment instead of like breaking things down as far as, you know, what I see that are going to be important points I might need to know. So I do just a general read through, and then I'll do another read through where I try to pull bits or notes about the characters out of it. And I do that before I have any meetings with the director or writer. Another thing I usually will do is I start to put together digital boards for like the general feel of things as well as for each character. So I do, now I do them digitally. Back a long time ago, it used to be just like cutting things out of magazines and stuff. Mm-hmm. But now I put together digital boards with images. So I'll do one specific to characters with inspiration images. And I'll also do ones that are kind of looks for some of the general group. Like on this show, we had just the town, like people in the town, or like that we would see it, some of the scenes in like the bar, things like that. And then we also had the bodybuilders, which was a whole, you know, separate specialty thing, because we filmed a scene that took place at a bodybuilding championship. So I knew we were going to have some specific looks for that.
Doesn't this take place in the 80s?
Yeah.
So
it's late 80s.
Town, but yeah. How does that era influence what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. So I took, because everything does come back around, and especially as we started talking about hair looks, like the shag and like kind of mullet variations. There's a lot of that currently that's come into popularity again, especially a lot of these like razored looks and very textured, like curly hair and hair that's like fluffy and wavy. So a lot of that that's come back into popularity currently. And so some of the stuff that I looked at, just looking at 1980s hair, because I was also looking at things that might be somewhat timeless, or could be like, if you looked at it, yes, it looks very typically 80s, but also you could envision it on someone today, possibly, you know, depending on how they were put together. I try to find research that isn't just things from like ads and photo shoots, which can sometimes be a little tricky. So things like yearbooks, or going through and finding photos that might have been in newspapers, or general photos of people. Sometimes what I do is also look for images of homeless people, actually, or street kids and stuff like that, because of I like seeing how worn down looks are for projects like this, where we want people to look not overly pretty and like done. We want to have more of a weathered look on a lot of the characters. So I'll also pull up images that maybe aren't from the U.S. as well. Like sometimes I try to find images from areas that, you know, maybe even from today, but mm-hmm. just that also I can take a look at hairstyles that are on people who aren't necessarily trying to be trendy, looking at film and TV from that era. So looking at, you know, movies and television from the 80s, okay. I'm just old enough. Some of the movies that I found some inspiration from were actually more early 90s, but just because of the looks. So Richard Linklater's Slacker, that took place in, I think it was early 90s. It was more like 1990. And then the movie Gummo and the movie Kids were two other ones that I looked at, because while they took place in the 90s, I liked that characters looked worn down and there were some natural things happening with their hair in those films. People didn't look done, or if they did have a look, it looked like they did it themselves. And some of the haircuts look like maybe the person did them themselves, you know, that type of thing. And there's another film I looked at that's also more early 90s, High Art, that had Ally Sheedy in it. That was another early 90s film, but some of the looks carried over a little from the late 80s into the early 90s. So that was one that had two female lead love interests in it, which was another reason why I thought about looking at, you know, looking at some of the stuff, because I remembered in that film, there was also a naturalness to the hairstyles in that that I liked and appreciated, and also the kind of masculine and feminine shorter hair on women, like where they could still have softness and kind of go either direction, which was another, you know, another thing I was looking at, especially with going into a shorter haircut with Lou's character too. So I think, and I may have pulled this from somewhere in my head, but I feel like during prep at one point, Rose, our director, mentioned Saturday Night Fever. And because somewhere I had that, and I was looking back through my notes, and somewhere I had Saturday Night Fever written down. And I do remember looking at that movie, and not because it's the same era either. It's a little prior, but that is the thing when you're looking at time periods. I usually look at a few years prior and sometimes a few years after, because also depending on where you are regionally, things don't always catch on at the same time. Like if you're in a small town in New Mexico, what's trending? I mean, especially back in like the 80s, it wasn't like there was social media being flooded with what's like hot and trendy. Things would come later, you know, to smaller towns if you weren't, you know, if you weren't in a big city. And sometimes they'd carry over way longer than they were popular. Like thing looks like, say, like the mullet or the shag. Or I went to beauty school way, way past the 80s, you know, way later than the 80s and prior to when the like Euro mullet became fashionable. And I had someone while I was in beauty school that wanted a mullet. And I was like, this is not it. And then a non-ironic way, like they were like still rocking what they'd been wearing since probably the, you know, the 80s, or it came later, you know?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when I saw the trailer, I can't lie, when I saw Ed Harris, who's obviously an amazing actor, when I saw his hair, I was like, that's someone hanging on to a style.
Yeah. And he had, that was a actor driven, like he really liked the idea of having longer hair. I think that is not something I would have thought to like put out to Ed Harris as a, you know, as an actor necessarily, because it's such a extreme look and variation away from his usual, but it really did give that feel. And I mean, there were some points where it was like, okay, like this does make him like the kind of creepy vibe from him with that long hair. That's like, why do you still have that? Like, cut it off, you know?
Megan, if you don't mind, just for the listeners, because I've seen it and you've obviously created it, just break it down for them. Why does it look so, what's the creepiness about it?
So the actor Ed Harris plays Lou Sr. And he has in his day-to-day life, he has pretty much no hair through the top of his head. And he has fine short hair around the sides and kind of that horseshoe pattern. And so he usually wears it very close to the head. For this project, he actually had I-tip extensions installed. So he had extensions installed that were in for the run of the show. And so they were, you know, movable. He didn't have to have like a wig or an appliance put on every morning. So his day to day was pretty quick. But they are down past his shoulder.
And they're just in the film. Right?
And they're pretty much just kind of from behind the temple, like just in front of the ear, and go around into that area. So there's still no hair on top. So in some scenes he has it down, and in other scenes it's in a ponytail where basically there's nothing on top. It's just a ponytail, which I think I know I have seen that on men, especially in like the late 80s, early 90s. I know like you'd see guys that were kind of just holding on. My father actually wears a ponytail, and I told him that if I ever see that happening to him, that I would cut it off in his sleep.
So Tell me whose look was the most challenging to define.
I would say definitely Jackie's, because it was so far from her look. Jackie is the bodybuilder character who becomes Lou's love interest, played by Kristen Stewart. So Jackie is coming through town, and, you know, the looks we were looking for this character before we knew who was going to be cast was something very soft, because her hair, her body, we knew was going to be really muscular and built and angular. And so the looks we were looking for hair wise were things that had a lot of softness and curl and texture. Some of the inspiration for her character was there was a bodybuilder in the 80s named Lisa Lyon, who was used for inspiration. I also looked at Jennifer Beals from Flashdance, like that soft, very curly brunette hair. And then actually a picture of my mother from the 80s, because she had super curly hair. And she had like a curly shag in the 80s. She hated it. But those were some of the images we were looking at. And it became apparent very early on that for them to find not only an actress who would be strong in that part and playing a love interest opposite Kristen Stewart and some of the, you know, scenes that they were going to be involved in, but also someone who had the build and the ability to look pro bodybuilder level fit, which is, you know, beyond even, you know, and so when they brought on Katie, she had buzzed hair on the sides. So her hair was clipper short on the sides and she just had a bit of length on top. So it was a pretty contemporary short woman's cut. So at that late of a date, the thing that was a challenge was it was too late to have a custom build done on a wig, even with a rush. We didn't have enough lead time by the time the actress was brought on to the project to get a full wig built. And, you know, budgetarily wise as well, there wasn't quite enough in the budget to have, you know, multiple wigs built. So additionally to that, there were still some supply chain issues with getting human hair lace wigs. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't, you know, some of the colors were just, there's either weren't available. So I was able to source some full lace wigs in a brunette color, but I had to customize them to her. So they were already built. And then when she was brought on board, I did fittings with her to get them to fit her head shape and size. Mm-hmm. And then also I had to cut them and augment the color for the texture. I didn't want to perm them because we were working with, you know, this wasn't virgin hair on these wigs. And so I ended up doing wet sets on, we had two wigs that we alternated for. But in the initial prep period, we were also trying to, you know, decide on color, length, texture. I did wet sets using flex rods, the kind of like noodle rollers, because I didn't want it to look like there'd been a curling iron in the hair. I wanted it to look more like someone with curly hair and be able to like move it around and it not get crunchy. I also knew that there were going to be intimate scenes, which are always challenging because it's hard to get in, and you can't be in a bedroom scene constantly checking someone's hair. And so the thing with when wigs come up, as far as like going to put a character in a wig, especially with little lead time, I think, you know, people do get nervous. Will it work on camera? And is it going to look foreign on this person?
Honestly, from the trailers, it looks like you did it because, like I said before we started recording, it was the hair that instantly hit me like, wow, they've paid so much attention. Because it's true, isn't it? It's like all these little things, they're little to us, but you've spent so many hours, minutes thinking about it and changing things. I just can't get over such a short lead time. I feel like every time I do an interview with someone from TV or film, it's getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
Like there's no six months, year.
It depends on the project, but I feel that. I think a lot of the time, I mean, there's many times where we're kind of, I say like I'm in like soft prep mode, but there's a limit to what we can really prep for when we don't know who's going to be these characters. And sometimes things change too. You know, sometimes casting changes along the way, you know, before anyone even knows about it, that can happen sometimes.
So that was Megan Dom talking about the challenges of creating a feminine hairstyle that makes sense on a more sculpted, muscular body. I really loved all of the details that she shared here, especially when it comes to making each character feel real and the sheer breadth of her inspirations. You can tell that I think she just really enjoyed this. Next, we're going to chat to costume designer Olga Mill. I start by asking her, what is her starting point when it comes to prep?
A lookbook that usually doesn't even really have anything to do with costumes. It's just kind of like a visual meditation or an emotional response to the script. That's kind of all collage-y. And then, it's just doing a lot of more kind of practical research of like the actual clothes, right? And I think it's like almost kind of a numbers game. It's like how many photographs, how many visuals can you get in front of your eyeballs? And then you kind of start to have, I don't know, I kind of try to let myself have a visual, like a visceral response to images of like, yes, no, you know? And put together like research boards for each character, and then I'll share that with Rose, the director. I'll then share that with the cast, and sort of each person is kind of like, oh yeah, like a little bit of this, a little less of this, whatever. You just kind of are like guiding this thing down the river. And then, you know, that first fitting, I always kind of like to call like a primer coat, right? Like the expectations are not like, oh my God, we're going to like find the character or we're going to solve all the things. The first fitting, you kind of expect the first like hour or two to just be like, that's not right. And then, you know, hopefully from that first fitting, you get like one or two pieces that feel like an anchor for the character. And then from that, you can like build out the rest of the closet.
I love that. It makes me want to ask you, what were the anchors for the two key characters then? I'm really intrigued.
Oh, really good question. I think for Lou, it was like in that first fitting, we found the pair of jeans that she wears during a big portion of the film. And then there's also this like, it doesn't have a lot of screen time, but there's the vest that she wears in the restaurant scene. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this like other kind of like vest that she wears in the very beginning when she's driving to her sister's house for the first time. And those were things that like kind of, you know, survived from the first fitting. But those were the first time where it was like both Kristen and I were like, oh, yeah, I think like it's starting to congeal. I think she's somewhere in there, and then built it out from those. And then for Jackie, you know, her closet felt like it had a little bit less variables, right? Like we knew it was going to be a lot of gym clothes, right? So it wasn't, with Lou, it was more like, oh, this can kind of be anything. With Jackie, it was a little bit more, the parentheses were smaller around what it could be. There was like those pair of gray sweatpants felt right. I think that was a big anchor piece. And her sneakers, I think, survived. But the challenge with her was more about tailoring the pieces versus like who is she? It was more like, okay, she's going to be in a sports bra. She's going to be in some sweatpants, but like getting them to fit quite right was more of the challenge.
I feel like I really remember a pair of shorts that she wore for some reason, some striped shorts.
Oh yeah. That was a big one.
In the workout.
montage. The striped shorts, like I found a piece of research from the 80s that had those like a striped pair of shorts. And we were like, oh, we love it. It's kind of, she's going to be in them for so long. So you don't want them to be boring, you know? And our assistant designer, Bailey Gardner, found a pair of striped shorts like somewhere in the depths of the internet. And we ordered them, but then something I wanted to do, like I found there was like so much branding in 80s athletic wear, but we couldn't really use like, you know, existing brands because the film is so violent. So like those shorts have a little graphic on them that we designed and had printed on. And then our tailor really like tweaked those shorts so much to like go up on the side. It was almost like we just used them for fabric. But that was kind of the process with those.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't think of that. I guess you couldn't put Nike or Adidas or Reebok.
I know. Everyone was like, no, thank you.
I love that. Whose look would you say was the most challenging? So you get past that, you know, that primer part, but whose look overall was the most challenging to really nail?
Sometimes I feel like a film is like how people describe childbirth. You're like, I forget all the hard parts. I'm like, oh, it was like, none of it was a challenge. It was all really easy. I think actually like creatively, maybe that's the part I'm blanking on, but I felt like, oh, okay, we found who these people are. I think the real challenge was the fact that because it's, there's so much like action and blood in the movie, you might find like the most gorgeous, perfect vintage thing, but because you need multiples of it, you're kind of limited, or there's like, that's the bonus round is like, you need to find a vintage thing that has a bunch of multiples. So I would say that was like the biggest challenge, is making a period film that has a lot of, blood in it.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it now. So when we were first arranging this chat, I hadn't seen it, but yeah, I can't wait to see it again though. I can't wait to take my husband to see it.
I was even surprised. I mean, like, because some of the blood, like, you know, the jaw of it all was done in post. So yes. Even when I saw that at Sundance, I was like, oh, it's so much.
So they could do that in post as well. I literally thought you would have seen that a prosthetic, you know, at the time.
We did. I mean, there was definitely blood on the day and we did that. But in terms of like, yeah, the full scope of it, of the jaw of it all was done in post. And it actually made me, I was talking to somebody about it recently about how like desensitized we are to violence. So like kind of like how far it has to go in order to elicit like a real visceral reaction. And sometimes it's with like quantity, right? Like it's like a big battle scene and that really gets at your heart. But I thought this was at least the two times I've seen it with an audience where it feels like everyone has a real like, oh, visceral.
Oh, I saw people like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like how far you have to push it in order to like get that reaction. Yeah. And I actually think it's really hard to elicit that reaction from an audience at this point because people are so desensitized. And that really goes to like Rose's skill in a way of how to like, you know, pull at an audience's reaction. Cause I thought it was very effective for myself included. I was like, ooh.
It was very effective because it instantly, when I was thinking about the film afterwards, I was like, what are the films that it reminds me of? And one film was American History X, and it's purely,
yes,
without giving
jaw.
Too much detail away, but the jaw took me to that. And I can't remember how old that film was, but that was a wow moment.
You're so right. And I didn't connect those dots, but I don't remember anything else about American History X, except, and even now you're just saying it and I have like a feeling in the back of my throat that is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I've gone really hot because it's brutal.
It's so brutal. Yes, and it's a good comp. I didn't think about that.
But isn't it funny how, just to go off topic slightly, it's an audience that will complain, right, when something's too much. But it's the audience that has been accepting and absorbing these things for years and is okay to play games that do that, and it's okay to watch a HBO series that shows it, you know? So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, like what
Last question.
violence you're accept is acceptable or not. I don't know. It's all kind of very interesting, like psychologically to unpack.
For sure. And I will say, I did notice that everybody that went was like early 20s, easily, young 20-year-olds. So I was like, oh, okay, that means that they're not so used,
So used to it. Interesting. And then everyone else was like, who cares?
I'm gonna get a coffee after this. So, just last question. What for you is the most rewarding part as the person who's in charge of wardrobe and bringing these looks to life? What for you, now you've seen the film, what's the most rewarding part for you?
I actually think the part that I get a visceral kind of like, oh, this is so cool feeling is like in the fitting room. Like I just think like what actors have to do is really hard. Like I have so much respect for it. I think when done well, it's so incredibly hard. It's really vulnerable. There's so much technical stuff around it too. Anyway, I just think it's very hard. And then when you kind of have a moment in the fitting room where somebody puts something on and it's like their center of gravity changes, like how they hold their body changes. It's not really so much about like outward in. I really think it's about like inward out. Like it's hard to describe, but you can kind of it like feels like a certain kind of like, I don't know, alchemy that happens when somebody's their the way they hold themselves changes. And that part, like I just think is so cool. One, I feel like it's like you're helping them get to a place they need to go. It's just like very, there's something very kind of like playful about it too. Like not to be too cheesy, but in the way that like when you're a little kid and like you're playing dress up and it can really like change the way you feel in your reality. So yeah, I think there's something about that where you're like, oh man, like a different pair of like a different belt, and all of a sudden you've like unlocked something, is super cool.
That was Olga Mill, and I know we went off on a bit of a tangent with the violence conversation, but I really do think it's relevant to where we are today, especially where we are today in life, in the movies, in reality. But aside from that, I really loved hearing her talk about that moment when a character finally makes sense in the fitting room. It feels like it's such a magical moment. I can literally imagine what it's like when things just click into place. Now it's time for my final guest, head of makeup Frida Valenzuela. And Frida really set me off on a tangent in this conversation because she started off by bringing up a woman that I recognized from some photographs by the late, great Robert Mapplethorpe. This woman was called Lisa Lyon, and she was the first woman to win the Women's World Pro Bodybuilding Championship in 1979. I will likely have to make a video just about Lisa because she was definitely one of the first examples of a woman with serious muscle who could still be seen as attractive. Let's remember, definitely back in the day, muscles on women would have been seen as butch, scary, intimidating. And while that's definitely outdated now, I think some people still feel that way. So you can only imagine what an impact a woman like Lisa Lyon would have made when men back then would have been used to seeing these tiny, super slim gym bunnies bouncing around with fake boobs, wearing leotards, doing aerobics, definitely not lifting heavy weights, and definitely not being able to pick up men like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm definitely going to share an image of Lisa with Arnold Schwarzenegger on her shoulders in my newsletter for you to check out. But I just thought it was important to share this background with you just to let you know just how important Lisa Lyon is in the world of bodybuilding, but also when it comes to beauty standards. What I really like in this conversation is Frieda's actually going to start off with why Lisa Lyon was a very personal inspiration for her, not just as a makeup artist working on this film, but as someone who really loved bodybuilding herself.
The first person that came to mind was Lisa Lyon. She was kind of the pioneer for female bodybuilding. And I saw her photos and I was like, wow, I want to look like that. So I started training. I had the curly 80s wavy hair like hers and everything. And so that was just my inspiration for the Jackie character immediately. And then when I got the photos of Jackie and saw that we were going to use a wig, I had already sent some photos to the producers of what my inspiration was.
Wow. I love that. I love that you've made it personal because it's, yeah, it just feels like you can already envision the character. And I know for some people, if they can't take it back to something, they have to go to, you know, the books, magazines and yearbooks. But it sounds like you had it already in your mind. So how did you begin to put that into use then when it came to designing makeup? Because I always feel that designing makeup for film is a really specific job because it's not like getting celebrity ready for the red carpet and looking perfect. You're kind of meant to be using makeup as if that person applied it themselves kind of thing. So what were the... Because I wouldn't say I massively noticed that either one of them wore a lot of makeup. Do you know what I mean? So how did you use makeup to bring the characters to life?
Yes, they were both kind of natural with their makeup. But the other thing, too, is that the setting, even though it was essentially in the 80s, it's also set in a small town. Mm-hmm. That makes a big difference because it's not the regular standard, like, fashion 80s makeup. Small towns, a lot of times, they aren't always quite up to date, especially back then without the internet. They aren't always quite right there, even though they want to be there and they'll see the magazines and they'll see the makeup and they'll try it out. And because also Jackie's character, she wasn't a person, her character, that was going to mess with a lot of makeup. But she wanted to look nice, you know, so it was a matter of keeping it believable with the character. And also, you always have input from the actor, how they feel about the look. And I respect that very much because for me, it's a team project. It's a project. Okay, we're going to partner together. We're going to create this character, you know. And so it's and also dealing with the director. What kind of look do you want? So it's kind of like it's a team effort of bringing everything together and also dealing with Megan, who was department head for hair, who's wonderful, and also Olga with the costuming and everything. It all comes together. Those are all the tools that actors use. Yeah. So it was kind of that situation. And I kind of really did build my look a lot off of Lisa Lyon's look.
I'll definitely be sure to, because I've mentioned, I've been meaning to make a video about Lisa Lyons for a while because one of my favorite photographers did a lot of work with her, Robert Mapplethorpe.
Yes.
So, because, you know, yes, he's very attracted to showing like this different kind of beauty and, you know, a muscular woman. So
right.
I definitely want to share stuff with the listeners because I always try and paint a picture for what they're listening to. So, but...
I have that book. I had that book in the 80s.
Really?
I had the Robert Mapplethorpe book with Lisa Lyon. I don't know what happened to it. I had Lisa Lyon's training books. I had, you know, I had all of that.
What would you say was the most challenging aspect of your job on set?
The most challenging aspect was because I was pretty much focused on Jackie because she had a lot of changes she was going through. It may, makeup wise, it may not look like it in the final product. There's a lot of stuff we didn't see. And it was just, keeping the looks consistent and continuity and stuff like that. And, you know, just making sure that she was comfortable and just contributing to the whole flow of the project. She was amazing to work with. She was lovely, very patient. And, you know, her and I really talked a lot about training.
Okay.
We talked very much about training. And, you know, she was also continually training through the whole project, where she got more lean and more cut. So by the time that we got to the bodybuilding competition, I mean, she was, her whole body, it just changed. Even though she looked pretty good when she started.
She looked amazing.
Yeah.
Like, my husband's a personal trainer. So I've got I've always been into the gym as well, but not to that extent, because I believe it's a whole other discipline.
Yes, it is.
It literally is a discipline.
Yes.
But I just thought Katie looked amazing. I like her as an actress anyway, but the scene where it's like the montage, there's always a good montage in a good movie,
right,
of the working out and obviously the steroids, but she does look amazing. I'm going to go and see it again and take my husband, because that's the lifestyle that he's known from, you know, his job. So I think it came together. I feel like the film was really authentic, and it might not have been, but it seems like it was just the right people, the right team, the right actors that made it very believable. And I enjoyed it. But what did you enjoy? What was the thing that you enjoyed the most about working on this film?
Just the whole aspect of the bodybuilding and the being in the 80s. The other thing I really enjoyed is when they had the competition. Mm-hmm. Because back in that day, the bodybuilders, they were different. I mean, even down to the color of the tan that they use.
Oh,
because in the 80s, it was a different color. And now it's almost like this deep, dark brown. They get very dark. But in the 80s, yeah, it was this beautiful golden bronze kind of look, you know.
Really?
And yes.
I wasn't expecting you to say that. I thought you might say maybe it was more orange, but you're saying it was like a bronze.
It was a different color. And, you know, the reason I knew that, I mean, even though I do exhaustive research when I'm working on a project, especially if it's a particular milieu or if it's a generational or period. And the thing is, I knew the look. I'd seen it. I'd been there. I'd been to the competitions in the 80s. I'd seen all of that. And I used to buy all the bodybuilding magazines so I could learn how to train better. So I knew the look. And when we cast our professional bodybuilders, I was sending notes. It has to be this color. You can't do the dark brown, da da da. I mean, even down to the nail colors, the shape of the nails, everything. You know, and of course, Jackie, we kept her very natural, right? But yes, when the bodybuilders came, I said, okay, you can't do the stiletto nails. You can't do the outrageous designs. You know, these are the colors. And I would send notes for makeup, you know. And then I had a team of background makeup artists who were excellent. They did a lot of tattoo cover on the bodybuilders, because in the 80s, they didn't have tattoos.
No way. So tell me, what did you use? I really want to know, what did you use on her body then to get that kind of more 80s style?
Well, when we went to her competition is when I started using body makeup on her, and I used a lot of Sally Hansen. It's a leg makeup.
The spray?
No. It's not a spray. Oh. I use a cream. She's got a beautiful cream color, and I apply it with a very large brush all over the body, and it's also very waterproof. So when we had to shine them up, which we use spray-on sunscreen to shine them up, because if you spray a lot of that spray-on sunscreen on it, it looks like a sheen or almost a sweat. So we used a lot of that. And I used that primarily on her for all her bodybuilding stuff. But, this was a really, really, I'm so proud of this project. I mean, I've been in the business for a long time. I'm very proud of this. I'm so happy the way it came out. It was a great story. I thought that Kristen and Katie were amazing, because a lot of times when I'm working, I'm watching the monitor, or checking them. I'm looking at the makeup. Mm-hmm. What's moving? What's changing? Uh-oh, they did this. I may have to fix this. Da-da. So a lot of times I don't always notice the performance. So when the project is finished and I go in and I'm like, wow, you know, and it was just, it was so lovely. It was really great.
I thought whoever did the music did a really good job at making it 80s as well.
I thought it was great. And I also, because I was so busy with Katie, the only other actor I was really able to work with was Anna Baryshnikov, who played Daisy.
Oh my gosh, really? Daisy, yeah. The girlfriend?
The girl with the bad teeth and everything.
Oh, the bad teeth. Did you give her those bad teeth?
Yes.
They are bad. Like, believably bad.
No,
but she was a great character.
Great. And her makeup design was so much fun because, again, because it's set in a small town, we're not going to go strictly high fashion 80s, but I put the elements in there, like with the icy blue shadow and the brighter pink blush. And even with her and with Jenna, the characters to me, I completely think out the whole makeup down to the nail color. So that kind of little frosty pink from the 80s that I had on Anna's nails, that was a thing. Yeah, this is the color. And then we had kind of a bubblegum pink for Jenna. They're not always things you notice, but as soon as I don't address that is when they're going to focus on it. I've just been in the business too long, you know. But it's interesting because sometimes in all the mix, even some directors or producers, when I'll be talking, especially if it's a specific character, and I'll go, and a female, obviously, or a male, and I'll go, okay, so the nails, and they'll kind of look at me like, what? And I go, yes, that's part of the whole look, you know? What kind of nails are we going to do? Are they going to be this? Are they going to be that? So it's just looking at everything and looking at the whole picture. And all of that.
So that was my final guest, Frida Valenzuela, talking about what sounds like such a personal kind of throwback for her. I feel she must have got so much from this film, and you can really see what she's talking about when it comes to all of the aspects that bring the bodybuilding world to life when you go see the film. And I really do need you to go see the film because then we can talk about it. I'm so glad that I can finally share this episode now the film is out. It came out last week in the UK. And again, I just really want to say thanks to Megan, Olga and Frida for chatting with me. Now, at the beginning of the show, I mentioned how Showgirls has that cult movie status. But I don't want you to think that by me saying Love Lies Bleeding is going to be the next big cult classic, that I'm saying the two movies are equal or resemble each other. I think what a cult movie is it's a movie that finds a very specific audience who treasures it and champions that film forever. So no matter whether it's not, you know, picked up by the masses, it just endures. And I think Showgirls endures for one reason and Love Lies Bleeding is going to endure for another reason entirely. Now, I really want to know, if you are planning on seeing Love Lies Bleeding, please let me know if you're headed to it in the UK. Or if you are one of my US listeners, let me know. Have you seen it already? I'll be sure to leave links to the hair, makeup and wardrobe pros that I've spoken to in this episode, as well as any other links that I've mentioned. If you enjoyed this episode, do please leave a review or rating wherever you like to listen, because it really helps the show to be found by others. And don't forget, there's also a newsletter that you can read for free at beautymenotes.substack.com where I will share imagery from the film. Thanks so much for being here and I'll see you next time.